I would like to introduce Kevin Pence, who is a staff member with a new organization called Beyond Nuclear, and formerly was my co-worker for the last 10 years for information resources. Well, we have another whole hour, so I get you get to kind of decide how you'd like it to go.
Okay, so when I enter, Yeah, like Mary said, I first met Mary on this very issue, really, that we call Mobile Chernobyl. And when we say that, what we mean is when Chernobyl exploded and burned, and its high-level radioactive waste or its irradiated fuel went up in the smoke and really fell out all over the northern hemisphere, that was Chernobyl. And the reason that we call this Mobile Chernobyl is that the very same material, really, high-level radioactive waste, irradiated nuclear fuel from nuclear reactors, is being proposed to be trucked or trained or barged under these various proposals. John mentioned the Yucca Mountain proposal, and that's how I met Mary back in the mid-90s. The big push back then was to get the waste that's piling up at the reactors in motion and get it out to Yucca Mountain as soon as possible, even though that site was being studied at the time. Is it suitable to bury high-level radioactive waste at this site in Nevada? And we could go on and on about the reasons why it's not, but they were still studying the site at the time, and there was legislation in Congress, the Mobile Chernobyl Bill, to get this stuff moving as fast as possible before the studies were done, out there, park it out there, and worry about the details later. But of course, once thousands and tens of thousands of these shipments were moved out to Nevada and parked there, there's no way they're not going to go forward with the dump, right? So it was a huge grassroots victory that didn't happen. And President Clinton's veto had a lot to do with it, and Nevada's politicians who filibustered in the Senate. But it was the grassroots that gave them the political cover and the political power to stave off that proposal. And so I call it the radioactive whack-a-mole game. You know that game at the county fair where you're whacking the mole? So when you whack Yucca Mountain, well, they pop up with another really bad idea. And so the really bad idea du jour is the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. And John touched on a lot of this. The only commercial reprocessing that's been done in the United States was at West Valley, New York, near Buffalo. And they only did commercial reprocessing there for 6 years, from 1966 to 1972. And in those 6 short years, they were only able to do 1 year's worth of reprocessing, the design throughput that they said they could do per year. It took them 6 years to do it. And it was because of the worker exposures, the accidental fires, the radiation releases. And then they closed down for all these problems they had that they were trying to fix. But then India exploded its bomb in 1974. And the way they had gotten the plutonium was they used a Canadian research reactor that was given to them by Canada. They used U.S. commercial waste reprocessing technology and know-how to reprocess the plutonium from the waste from this research reactor. And this was all being done secretly. And then the big announcement to the world that we are now a nuclear weapons power was they exploded a bomb in 1974. And it led to the Ford administration in 1975, and then the Carter administration, when Carter came in, banning commercial reprocessing in the United States. And it was to send a message to the world that this is a bad idea. It can lead to nuclear weapons like happened in India just a couple years ago. So that was a good thing that the U.S. did. And the U.S. stepped away from commercial reprocessing. Unfortunately, you know, the hypocrisy, the U.S. was doing military reprocessing at the time up until the late 80s, right? Is that how long it went on? Commercial reprocessing. Military.
They still actually do a little bit of cleanup reprocessing, but they stopped when Rocky Flats closed in 89.
Okay, so until 89, the U.S. was doing all-out military reprocessing, getting plutonium from radioactive waste from military reactors, not commercial reactors, to use the plutonium in nuclear weaponry. So that's the hypocrisy. And like John said a couple times, the blissful ignorance or the nuclear amnesia. That was one of our speaking tours up in the Great Lakes. We had the nuclear amnesia speaking tour. Mary came through. I'm from Michigan. And the nuclear amnesia is, they're proposing to do this commercial reprocessing at Savannah River site and at Barnwell.
well, what's the result of the military reprocessing that's been done there for decades? It's widespread contamination of the site, and one of the most heartbreaking, and hopefully we can reverse this mistake, but back in 2004, the Department of Energy, in one of the shadier moves I've experienced, and I've been doing this stuff since 92, they convinced Congress that the radioactive sludges in the underground storage containers at Savannah River site are actually not high-level radioactive waste, but they're actually low-level radioactive waste. And this was a paper fix. They waved a magic wand over these wastes that are difficult to get out of the tanks. They don't want to get them out. So all of a sudden, they're now low-level radioactive waste, and they got Congress to go along with this by the skin of their teeth.
They actually have their own category, right?
Waste incidental to reprocessing.
So it's incidental waste now. Yeah.
But the problem is that when you leave these sludges in these tanks, and they would pour concrete grout into the tanks, and then they would walk away. Concrete and the metal of the tanks is going to corrode and deteriorate over time. So we're talking maybe a few centuries into the future, these wastes are going to percolate, leach out into the Savannah River, into the Tuscaloosa Aquifer. And if this decision stands, then you're going to be writing off the Savannah River. It will not be fit for human drinking. Even under the Safe Drinking Water Act, it will be illegal to drink that water some centuries into the future. So they're proposing this not only at Savannah River site, military reprocessing center, but also they want to get away with it at places like West Valley, New York, which was a combination, by the way, of commercial reprocessing and military up there, because there wasn't enough commercial business back in the mid-60s, so the U.S. government was doing some military reprocessing up there as well. And I should have mentioned that 6 years of reprocessing at West Valley, the cleanup bill is $5 billion. And when you adjust for inflation, it's going to keep growing. They haven't done the cleanup up there, and it's been shut down since 1972. So out in Washington State, Hanford is another military reprocessing center, and again, there's radioactive contamination that's leaked out of these storage tanks. Liquid high-level radioactive waste has leaked out of these underground storage tanks, is moving in the groundwater towards the Columbia River. This is the history of military reprocessing. And the blissful ignorance, the nuclear amnesia, is we want to do it all over again. Only this time, it's a much greater quantity of material because there's a lot more commercial waste than there was military material. So I just wanted to add some of that history that we've made this mistake before, and now they want to make it again. But the heart of what I want to talk about are the transportation risks that would go along with this. And this would have applied to the Yucca Mountain proposal, and we're hoping to stop that dump so that the wastes don't move out there, because it's an earthquake zone, it's Western Shoshone Indian land, it's a volcanic zone. There's a lot of reasons that Yucca Mountain shouldn't happen. Even if the earthquake or the volcano didn't happen there, even if the Western Shoshone embraced this idea, which they don't, they reject it, if you buried the waste at Yucca Mountain, it's going to leak into the drinking water supply over time, because like John said, this material is deadly virtually forevermore. Even after 1,000 years, when the heat kind of dissipates, it's not so hot thermally after 1,000 years. And the gamma radiation, which is the fatal dose that you would get from being close to this stuff in the early years, so-called, dissipates after 1,000 years. So you've still got 1 million years of alpha emitting radiation, the plutonium that's deadly for so long. So the transportation risks, you saw what the routes look like, but and you touched on this too, but what are some of these risks in a little bit more detail? Well, in broad categories, there's kind of the spectacular risks. There's the severe accidents or the terrorist attacks that were touched upon. But there's maybe the less sexy issue of routine shipments, incident-free transports. Even with these overpacks, this radiation shielding over the waste, you still have gamma radiation that gets through that overpack. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allows a permissible dose, they call it, an allowable dose, to be coming off of these shipments as they're going down the highway or down the railway or on the barge. And Mary's sister coined this phrase, mobile x-ray machines that cannot be turned off. That's what these incident-free shipments are. So if you're stuck next to one of these things in a traffic jam, what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allows is if you're 6 feet away, you can get 10 millirem per hour. That's considered a permissible dose. That's a chest x-ray, give or take. So it's around the level of a chest x-ray. So every hour, 6 feet away, you could be getting a chest x-ray off of one of these shipments. At the surface, because the dose dissipates exponentially with distance, if you're closer, the dose goes up significantly. So if you're at the surface of these shipping containers, you can get a 200 millirem per hour dose. That's 20 chest x-rays per hour. And so the people who are looking at that kind of dose rate are the inspectors, the truck drivers, the locomotive engineers, the people working on the rails. The people who have to handle this stuff, work around it, are getting doses like that. And again, these are supposedly the maximum limits that they're not supposed to go above. So granted, some shipments may not be at the maximum limit, but they have permission to go there. And what I want to add about these routine shipments is that, you know, things don't always go according to plan. And the history from France is kind of instructional on this. Back in the 1990s, and this went on for decades, certainly for years and years this was going on. The shipments that were going to the French Commercial Waste Reprocessing Center, and these were coming from nuclear plants across France, but it was also materials coming from other countries because the French were reprocessing commercial wastes from Germany and Switzerland and a number of countries. You mentioned Italy now has a contract to send its waste up there. The shipping containers were radioactively contaminated on their exterior far above permissible doses. This was radioactive particles that were contaminating the exterior of the shipping container. And it turns out that 25% to 33% of the shipments going in to that facility were contaminated above regulatory limits. The biggest exceedance was 3,000 times the permissible level, but there were large numbers that were 500 times the permissible level. And this was covered up by the French nuclear industry and by the transport industry and by the French safety regulator until activists and investigative journalists blew the story open in 1998, I think it was. So this can happen here.
Say his name. Michael
Schneider, World Information Service for Energy in Paris, was key to exposing this truth to the world. And we have a history. Bob Halstead was mentioned. He's transportation consultant to the state of Nevada, fighting against the Yucca Mountain program. And he has documented from 1948 to 1996 was his report. And he documented 50 instances here in the United States of high-level waste shipments that were externally contaminated above regulatory dose limits. So we have 50 examples here. In France, it was many hundreds of documented examples of that. So you'd be getting a much higher dose than that chest x-ray per hour if you were stuck next to a contaminated shipment. But I also want to move on to the accident potential and the potential for attacks. So, you know, the news most recently of the Interstate 35 bridge collapse in Minnesota. Right when I heard about it, I emailed Bob Halstead right away because he's a walking encyclopedia of routes for nuclear waste shipments. And wouldn't you know it, they were already looking into it. I mean, I just saw the headline on internet, and they're already trying to figure out if Prairie Island, Minnesota nuclear power plant's wastes might have taken that route. And I don't know the answer back yet. They were thinking it could have been a secondary route, like you were saying, if the dispatcher decided that the primary route, for whatever reason, wasn't good. So there was the highway, there's a rail under that bridge the bridge fell on a train and snapped the train in half. And then there's the river, the Mississippi River, too, for barge shipments, potentially. So it's being looked into. But there have been other spectacular accidents that were on documented Yucca Mountain routes. So the Baltimore train tunnel fire in 2001, it did not have radioactive waste on board, but the point is that it could have if the Yucca Mountain program were underway, if we hadn't stopped it. There was a train going through an underground tunnel under downtown Baltimore in July of 2001, and apparently a braking system snapped. It caused sparks, and that's what set the train on fire. And it burned for several days. But for about the first 24 hours, it burned at a temperature of around 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And it just so happens that the NRC design criteria for these nuclear waste transportation containers. For fire accident scenarios, the temperature they're worried about is 1,475 degrees. So the fire that was burning inside the Baltimore Tunnel was at or above that temperature. But the NRC design criteria is for a 30-minute fire. And the fire that burned in that tunnel for hours and hours on end above that temperature shows that these design criteria are not strong enough. There was another accident right at the time of the Yucca votes back in 2002 when Congress pretty much said, okay, DOE, go ahead, apply to the NRC for a license to operate the site in Nevada. And that's still in process. There was a bridge collapse because a barge hit a Interstate 40 overpass in Oklahoma. And I'm forgetting what river it was above. But again, cars plunging into the river below. So these accidents happen. And the reason I mention that one and also the Minnesota bridge collapse is that the design criteria for really for falls was a 30-foot fall. So these bridges are much higher up than 30 feet. And granted, the design criteria is for unyielding surface below, but the bridge abutments and the concrete that's down there are pretty unyielding too. So for all these reasons, a severe accident could breach one of these containers. And you gave the figure of comparing the waste to the Hiroshima bomb. Another figure that we use is from Dr. Marvin Resnikoff in New York City, that the truck shipments, because they're smaller containers, at least under the Yucca Mountain program, the truck shipments were going to be smaller containers. 40 times the long-lasting radioactivity that was released at Hiroshima is contained in these truck shipments. So 40 times Hiroshima. And the comparison is the radioactive cesium isotopes that were released at Hiroshima and the radioactive cesium isotopes that are in the high-level radioactive waste. So it's actually a conservative figure because it's only looking at the cesium, and there's hundreds of radioactive poisons in the waste, not just the five cesium isotopes. And then the train shipping containers are much bigger, and the barge shipping containers are the train-sized ones. 240 times Hiroshima. So that's kind of a good segue. I mean, for the accident, if you breach one of these containers and you release just a fraction of the contents, that's a radiological disaster right there. And if it's combined with a fire, especially, that's going to put it up in the smoke and it's going to fall out downwind for long distances. So that's why we called it Mobile Chernobyl. So September 11th, you know, puts terrorism on a lot of people's minds. And again, this was brought out in John's presentation. What we're talking about under these transport programs, granted the waste is at the reactor sites, but it's sitting still. So that was one of my favorite lines from Mary was, this stuff is pretty darn dangerous going 0 miles per hour. Now you want to put it at, you know, 65 out on the highways. But the potential for attacks as this material is moving through major population centers or other places that, you know, a terrorist group might want to attack it at. Like, if it's going through the Great Plains, that would be the food supply of the country. Or if it's on a barge on the Great Lakes, that's the drinking water supply for tens of millions of people. So I wanted to mention that there was a test done at Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland in 1998. This is a U.S. Army facility where they took a German Castor cask. This shirt is from the German anti-nuke movement fighting these shipments going into Gorleben, Germany, a farming community that doesn't want to be a dump. So the Castor is considered to be the Cadillac of shipping containers. It's 15 inches thick of die-cast iron. And they took a TOW anti-tank missile at the Aberdeen Proving Ground. And they didn't fire it, so the kinetic energy wasn't even a part of the test, which would make it even stronger. They just put the TOW explosive on the container, and they blew it up. And it put a hole about this big around through that 15 inches of metal. And it's because the TOW missile is designed to penetrate tank armor. And then they did a second test where they put a concrete shielding in front of the TOW missile. So between the TOW missile and the container was this thick concrete, maybe 2 or 3 feet thick. And that second TOW missile just obliterated the concrete, turned it to dust, and it blew away. And what they were trying to prove with this test, it was actually paid for by the German container company, was to show that they have this concrete radiation shield, this concrete material that could be a shield against TOW missiles. So if you're going to store this stuff at your reactor site, you're going to want to put this concrete. They already put concrete at the storage sites at reactors for radiation shielding. It's to try to cut back on the dose that workers are going to get working around the material. But they didn't really design it as kind of a flak jacket for terrorist attacks. That was kind of an afterthought. So here was this company trying to market its concrete as like, okay, there's terrorists out there. And this test was done in 1998, so before September 11th. And then the reason they never really put that word out, it was going to be a commercial, this video they shot of the test, was because they didn't want people to realize that the shipping containers, which do not have the concrete, are vulnerable to terrorist attack. So they just held it back, and Congresswoman Berkeley from Nevada got a hold of the video somehow, and that got the word out a little bit. So we know that these things can be attacked, and if you do punch a hole that big around in one of these shipping containers, you now have a pathway for the deadly contents to get out. And if you combine it with a fire, so if the attack involves an incendiary weapon, then you've got the release mechanism to cause a radiological disaster. And there was another test done way back in like 1980, the late 70s, early 80s, at Sandia National Lab in New Mexico, where again, this time the U.S. government tested another classified weapon system. It was some kind of remotely fired weapon at a shipping container. And the images were shown on Las Vegas TV. They got a hold of the images somehow in 1992. And it showed that the fuel rods, which that graphic had shown in John's presentation, had just been sliced through. It looked like, you know, it burned a path. So again, that would release radioactive gases, that would release radioactive particles into the smoke. And that would, I guess I'll end right now with the figures that Dr. Marvin Reznikoff did for the Baltimore train tunnel fire. What could one of these accidents or attacks look like in terms of doses and health consequences? So after the fire in the Baltimore train tunnel, the state of Nevada did a study. What if high-level radioactive waste had been on that train? Just a single container on a train car. And they determined that likely the container would have failed, it would have breached, and the contents would have been partially released. And I can't remember how much of a fraction of the contents they said were going to get out. But I do remember the casualty figures. So they determined that scores of people would have been exposed to enough radioactivity to kill them from cancer. Initially. So 100 people, let's say, would die from cancer because of the release. And then the question is, how long would it take to clean up the deadly fallout that came out? So if people continued to live in contaminated areas for a year, the number of latent cancer fatalities, people dying from cancer later on, grew to like 1,000. But if people lived in the contamination for 50 years, then the numbers went up to 30,000 latent cancer fatalities. And so kind of, you know, initially I was like, well, of course they're going to clean it up. Well, lo and behold, the Bush administration, Department of Homeland Security, to save money and to make everything okay for nuclear, had put out this proposal that the cleanup levels after a dirty bomb attack would allow for 10 rem per year exposure rates to people living in these contaminated areas. 10 rem per year over a lifetime, you're starting to talk about cancer rates of like 1 in 4 people getting cancer.
That's tolerated levels.
They wanted to make this the allowable dose rate for a cleanup job after a dirty bomb attack. So, you know, those figures are not far-fetched because they're willing to let people live in 10 rem per year of radioactivity. And they haven't gotten away with it. Another grassroots victory. There's so many of them. So. But those are the risks, and the final thing I'll close on is there was this group statement of principles for safeguarding radioactive waste at nuclear power plants that came out last September. There's about 150 groups on there, and we need to get a lot more groups on there. But what it says is the wastes are at the reactor sites, and we need to safeguard them there, we need to secure them there, we need to fortify them against attacks and accidents at the reactor sites. You can build fortifications when these things are sitting still. You can't fortify them when they're in transit. So some of these sites, to be fair, are not good places for this stuff to be stored. Even presently, there's a island in the Mississippi River. That's a Native American reservation that floods regularly. There's high-level radioactive waste there. There's the Great Lakes shorelines. There's the seacoasts with rising sea levels from global climate change. Mm-hmm. This stuff is going to have to move to safer locations, but we have to do it for good reasons and not for these bad reasons like Yucca Mountain or reprocessing. And the transport risks alone are reason enough to be careful.
Thank you.